Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Barbara Bogave. What are you doing this weekend? Would you like to come play paintball with me? I'm a few bodies short of a full team. You know what it is, right? It's that game where two teams run around in the woods and they pretend to fight, and everyone's armed with weapons that fire bullets that explode pigment all over you. Now, I should say, there are some people who think this is sick and barbaric and indicative of everything wrong with modern culture. But give me a break. What are games if not sublimated aggression? We all know this is not real. And playing paintball isn't just fun and games. You have to come up with strategies and develop teamwork and maybe use a compass and learn some wilderness survival skills. Hey, it's educational. And that's what some people say about video games. They do have educational value. Some of them might be a bit violent, and even more than a bit violent, and some of them involve shoot-'em-up type behavior. But does that mean we should discount them out of hand? I wonder if back in the Stone Age, people looked at the first cave paintings of men throwing spears and said, "Hey, wait a minute, that's too violent. Rub it out." This is an age-old debate, but that doesn't scare Chris Brooks. He's downloaded and booted up, and he says he's ready to investigate just what the story is with video and computer games until he gets a definitive answer. Failing that, until his computer screen says, "Game over."
It feels like I'm in some kind of virtual world. Well, of course I am. I mean, I'm here talking to you, but I'm not really with you, right? I'm on the radio with a bunch of cheesy sound effects. In fact, here comes one now. A virtual helicopter virtually overhead. Doc! Just kidding. But this is weird. It's like the start of a video game or something. What am I doing here?
You are on a mission.
I am?
That response is incorrect.
Oh, okay. I'm on a mission. What is it?
You are to find out if video games can be used for educational purposes.
Wow. A task to be accomplished, with several levels of difficulty, I bet. How will I do that?
You are armed with the following butt-kicking weapons. Curiosity. Research. A limited attention span, and a small to middling intelligence.
Gee, I sound like the lion in The Wizard of Oz. Or was it the Tin Man?
It was the Scarecrow.
Oh, yes, of course. Is that all?
No. You were also provided with an automatic pistol, an assault shotgun, a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, a three-barrel Ripper machine gun, some laser mines, and a selection of pipe bombs.
That'll be very helpful, thanks. Anything else?
You get extra points for stealing cars, running over pedestrians, shooting cops, and beating up women and old people with a baseball bat.
This is public radio. I don't know if I can do that.
Why not? You can do it on your home computer, on a PlayStation 2, the Nintendo GameCube, and the Microsoft Xbox. Anybody can.
But how do I...
Just shoot anything that moves.
You are about to embark upon a great crusade. The eyes of the world are upon you.
If you're going to make an educational documentary, it's got to be a good documentary. It's got to be a good show, not just education.
The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere mark you with you.
You must not feel fear. The fate of the world is in your hands.
Wow.
What are you waiting for? Christmas?
But how do I start?
Come on.
Attention span dangerously low.
Okay.
Attention span timing out.
No, wait, look! There's an alien coming to get me!
Payback time. Wasted.
Attention span restored.
Okay, but it seems like a pretty cheap way to do it.
Attention span dropping.
Again? Oh, okay, forget it. I'm just going to shoot my way into chapter one. Here I go! Wow, made it. Hey, what's this place?
Level one. the video game museum.
Oh, this is like video game paleontology. Hey, look over here. Here's the very first video game. Wow, this looks positively prehistoric. Just brush the dust off the label here. Something called Pong. Yeah, it says it dates back to 1975. Wow, I mean, that's eons ago. I mean, that's back when you were listening to...
Look at me. I'm the disco.
Scary. And you were probably listening to it on something called a record player. Imagine a world without MP3. Anyway, how would you even begin to describe this ancient game?
Description: a digital ping pong ball bounces off walls in slow motion.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
And you know, you played this game, Pong, in bars and cocktail lounges. Why? Because back then, there was no such thing as a home computer. Believe it or not. Well, if Pong is the kind of game you remember, you're going to have to do a little bit more work to play a modern video game like, say, EverQuest.
Now see how that guy is offering a res? That's a resurrection. If you die, you go back to your buying spot, right? Told you about that, did I? Once you die, you either have to go back to the zone where your corpse was and find it, or you can get a cleric to cast resurrection on it, which brings you back there. And once you die, you lose a certain amount of experience. But with these certain types of resurrections, the higher power they are, the more experience you would get back.
But this is like a university course or something. How long did it take you to learn all this stuff?
Oh, man, this took me like a month to actually learn all the basics.
Only a month?
I'm a quick learner of this.
I hope you were taking notes.
At certain levels, you get spells. Like, I get level 1 spells.
Okay.
As a pure caster, every 4 levels afterwards.
Okay.
Up to like level 24
or something. Okay, we get the point. It's complicated.
But every 4 levels, so I get
new
spells. Okay,
that's enough.
But I gotta buy
them. Stop! Somebody stop him.
You gotta get money for spells.
Payback time. Damn, I'm good.
You know, I don't know if we should be shooting people like this.
Yeah, piece of cake.
Well, I was just trying to make the point that video games have come a long way since Pong.
Really, since the mid-80s, the industry hasn't really looked back. In 2002, in North America alone, the industry did about $7 billion in revenue.
Just a second. Excuse me. Help?
This is the help menu. Need help?
Yes. Who's this guy?
Douglas Lowenstein, president of the Interactive Digital Software Association, the organization representing video game manufacturers.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Lowenstein.
Well, I think if you look at the people playing games today, we have a generation between 18 and 35 years old who grew up with computers, really the first generation that grew up with that technology as a central part of their lives. And then the generation right behind them, 2 to 17, is the first generation to grow up with the internet. So for both of these generations, increasingly, interactivity is something that they're very comfortable with.
And interactivity, is that the quality that makes video games so compelling?
Well, I think that there are a number of reasons the games are engrossing. If you look at them today, they're graphically very realistic. Secondly, they're very immersive. They really take you into places that in your own daily life you're not likely to go, whether it's on a sort of a mythological quest or being in a race car. It allows you to experience things in a very, very real way, in a very meaningful way, that nothing else does.
Allowing you to experience things in a very real way. Hey, this is good news for our mission. Or bad news, depending on your perspective. But news it is.
Good morning. In the news of this hour, a controversial video game arrives today in stores across North America. It's the sequel to one of the most popular and violent games of the past year. Grand Theft Auto 3 is a game where people steal cars, beat up women, and wreak havoc.
Now, about this mission we're on.
You are to find out if video games can be used for educational purposes.
Right. And the interesting thing is, the reason video games hit the headlines is because of their potential for education. Some people argue games like Grand Theft Auto teach. They say they teach violence.
Exposure to violent video games causes an increase in aggressive behavior. There's no doubt about it.
Help again?
This is the help menu.
This voice belongs to...
Craig Anderson, chair of the Department of Psychology at Iona State University. He testified at the Senate committee hearing on the impact of interactive violence on children.
In playing a violent video game, you have to choose to behave aggressively. In other words, you get practice as a player You get practice making the decisions to pull the trigger or to throw the punch or to, you know, launch the grenade. And that active participation itself may, in some sense, be a more complete learning tool than simply watching characters behave aggressively on a TV show or in a movie. In a lot of games, some of the first-person shooter games, there's a narrator that will say things like impressive or very good when you blow someone up with a good rifle shot. You get in one game, if you run over pedestrians in a particularly flashy way, you get extra bonus points or splatter points. And so, you know, if the content that's in the video game teaches how to think aggressively and how to decide to behave aggressively and then actually carry out the act, I mean, that's what's going to get learned.
Schools in the Denver area reopened today. Columbine High School remains closed. 14 students and a teacher died in the school Tuesday when two of the students fired more than 8 rounds.
Derek Harris and Dylan Klebold were dedicated computer game players. The Littleton massacre has raised concerns about the effect of violent video and computer games on children.
Targets eliminated. 7. Bonus points. 5.
Piece of cake.
So it's that simple. Playing Duke Nukem and Doom caused the Columbine High School shooting, ergo, video games have an educational effect, and my mission is accomplished.
That response is incorrect.
You mean it's not that simple?
Douglas Lowenstein.
I mean, that is such a simplistic understanding of human nature, because there's a big difference between people understanding a moral environment in which they live. You play a video game, oh, gee, I guess it's okay to get my dad's gun and go down the street and shoot all my friends. Well, people understand that's wrong. They live in a culture and a society which is and a value system that makes it absolutely clear how that is. And people kind of make believe none of that exists. And so to say that, well, gee, if you play a video game, it teaches you how to kill people. I mean, that just defies common sense when you think about it.
That's what makes this not so simple. Learning doesn't take place in a vacuum. And video games, just like homework, exist within a wider environment that colors their effectiveness as teaching tools. This means using video games for education may be harder than I thought. Craig Anderson.
The content doesn't sort of automatically make it either a good or a bad teaching tool. So the same kinds of process that we worry about in terms of violent games should, in fact, make video games a very effective way of teaching certain kinds of content. Unfortunately, there isn't a whole lot of research on the educational aspects. So it'd be a good starting point to talk about, yeah, this has, you know, we know it has these effects. Now let's see if we can design some games that have a positive effect, that teach people how to cooperate or how to do math problems or how to read.
You know, this mission is turning out to be more complicated than I figured. Now I've got to track down games designed to have positive educational effect. I guess this probably means...
Congratulations, you've completed level 1.
Yeah, thank you. I just figured that out for myself.
Would you like to move on to level 2?
Beam me up, Scotty.
Level 2.
I'm Henry Jenkins. I'm the director of the Comparative Media Studies program at MIT. I don't believe that games will turn kids into scientists, artists, or historians any more than I think games will turn kids into psycho killers. What I believe is that games give people an experience, and that what happens with that experience is shaped profoundly by their larger surroundings. But I mean, it's abundantly clear that kids will stay up all night to solve a problem they encounter in a game, and will spend about 10 minutes scrawling on a piece of notebook paper to solve a problem they see in a textbook. The problem is that when people use the word educational games, what they have in their mind is something that's dull as dishwater, and no, it's not going to sell.
Welcome to Math Blaster.
To win, zap the answers to the math problems. And they're off!
7 minus 2 equals 5. 2 minus 2 equals...
A lot of the early educational games were very drill-oriented.
Doug Lowenstein.
They took your multiplication tables,
from the piece of paper that you had to write with, and they put them into kind of an electronic environment, and maybe they had some characters there that made it a little bit more fun to do it and got some rewards. But ultimately, I think they weren't terribly engaging.
6 + 1 = 7.
I mean, one of the things that I've said to people over the years when they ask, well, gee, you know, the commercial educational games market is really soft. Well, it is. It's really, you know, not been a very successful marketplace. And the reason is that when was the last time, you know, your average 10-year-old asked mom or dad to get them Math Blaster?
Well, short my circuits. You placed second. That's worthy of a trading card.
You suck.
Now, just a minute. I thought we left you in level one.
Come on.
No, we're not talking about shooter games now. We're talking about games that build, okay? Like this.
You get to decide, will your world size be tiny or huge? Now you can have Pangeas, continents.
You're looking over the shoulder of 13-year-old Will Powelson. The game he's playing is called Civilization.
That determines the number of mountains.
This game challenges you to build up a civilization over a period of 6,000 years.
Clearing this forest will increase production.
Civilization is a commercial game. It was designed to be used the way Will is using it here, not in a school classroom. But it's more like the kind of educational game that MIT's Henry Jenkins talks about.
Something like Civilization 3 or SimCity, these are some of the most successful franchises in game history. They also happen to have embedded in them things the designer wanted to teach, models of how historical change built on the availability of resources. These were powerful lessons that were taught through commercially successful games. The paradox is that every time we get an educational game that sells extremely well, people stop thinking of it as an educational game.
Bonus point opportunity.
Oh, great. I'll take advantage of this opportunity to find out the secret of this game's success from the guy who designed it, Sid Meier of Firaxis Software.
Well, I think it's a matter of priorities. When we do a game, our first priority is fun. We have found, especially with our game Civilization, that people enjoy the learning process. And we really kind of make a distinction between learning and education. It's kind of funny for us. But people enjoy learning, but they don't necessarily enjoy being educated. And the distinction that we make is kind of that learning is something that happens at your own pace, following your own interest. Education is probably more of a curriculum format-driven process. The game essentially has to be fun. And if learning can be a part of the fun process, then that's a great feature. But we don't sacrifice any of the fun elements of the game to make it an educational process.
Bonus points, 1.
The only problem is you may or may not get educational bonus points when you play a commercial game outside of a structured learning environment. It really depends on what you bring to it. For example, remember Will Powelson, the 13-year-old playing Civilization? Well, here's another of his favorite games, Final Fantasy. It's not even designed to be an educational game, but in his case...
Anyways, this game is really what taught me to read. I got a PlayStation, and I got this game. Only problem was I couldn't read, and there was too much text. I eventually learned to read because I hated having to always have my dad to read everything. Since then, my ability to read has gone way up. If I could skip, I can just skip through all this, and I can just read it. I mean, I can read a book like the fourth Harry Potter, about 400 pages, in a day or two.
In Will's case, Final Fantasy motivated him to read, but it didn't happen in a complete vacuum. His dad was involved, for instance. For somebody else, in a different home environment, it might be another story altogether. Henry Jenkins.
Games by themselves are simply an experience that kids will make sense of in a variety of ways, and in all likelihood, that experience by themselves will be treated like any other fantasy that is something largely removed from the realm of their normal activity. So what we know when we think about games for education is that the game by itself may teach relatively little without the reinforcement of curricular activity in the classroom. The challenge is not simply to design games to teach, but to design curriculum that allows teachers to use those games effectively in a learning context.
This is the grade 5 health education class at the Smalley School in Bound Brook, New Jersey. The students are hunkered around computer monitors playing an educational game called Hungry Red Planet, a video game within the larger learning context of a school curriculum.
Let's say you click on a hard-boiled egg, it'll tell you how much fat, calories, and sodium it has.
This game is designed to teach basic nutrition, a lesson class teacher Greg Mott taught last year by standing in front of the class and lecturing.
When I approached my students in November saying we're going to be piloting this program and it's a game, it's a video game, they just, oh, they got all excited. Oh, we're going to do a game? I said, yeah, but you're also going to learn. You're going to have to, you know, basically learn all the way through to get to this game. And now they all come back, oh, I can't wait to go back. I'm learning so much about it. I've had a couple of parents actually come to me and say that, oh, my child's telling me I have to change my diet because I'm not eating the right foods. And obviously it's working. So I'm very happy with it. It's better than last year.
And the more you play it, the more healthy you learn how to eat.
Now, this mission that we're on...
To find out if video games can be used for educational purposes.
Yeah, in terms of that, this classroom looks pretty interesting. But I wonder if there isn't still a real gulf between a game like Hungry Red Planet, where you plan dinner menus in the classroom, like this.
Here is the menu planning screen. You can serve pizza and candy, or tofu and broccoli, it's all up to you.
And a top-selling commercial game like Grand Theft Auto, where you shoot cops and hijack cars, like this.
I am an officer of the law! Stop!
Now, part of the gulf between these games is money. The development budget for a game like Grand Theft Auto runs to several million dollars, and that's nowhere near the money going into developing games for the education market. But I wonder if money is only part of the story. Because over at MIT, Henry Jenkins and his colleagues are looking at other qualities that give some commercial games the edge.
For one thing, most educational games in the market today are utterly humorless, and that's part of the reason why they totally fail with kids. That the games that kids like have a sense of excitement, they tap deeply into the pulp roots of American popular culture. And I think any educational intervention needs to do that. There needs to be, you know, not out-and-out violence and brutality that people are frightened of about games, but certainly a sense of mild transgression.
Transgression. Now, that would be when you kind of cross into forbidden territory by doing things in the virtual reality of a game that would be unacceptable out in the real world. For example, saying things like,
"Damn, you're ugly."
Right. Or,
"What are you, some bottom-feeding, scum-sucking algae eater?"
"No, I'm Henry Jenkins."
"You're gonna die for that."
"Stop that! No, wait! Stop that! Now wait just a minute! I won't have you shooting my interviewees! Henry Jenkins is a highly respected academic!"
That response was invalid.
"I'll show you invalid. I'm unplugging your weapons right now."
"Look, Chris, I've still got the greatest confidence in the mission."
"This is my documentary, not yours."
"Chris, stop."
"Too late. There goes your assault shotgun."
"Stop. Will
there
you?"
"Goes your rocket-propelled grenade launcher."
"Stop, Chris."
"There goes your three-barrel Ripper machine gun."
"Stop.
What do you think of that?"
"I think I'll sing a little song."
"Fine. You go right ahead
and
do that while I take out
Daisy.
Every last one of your pipe bombs."
"Daisy, Daisy."
"There, that's done.
Give me your answer."
"I'm terribly sorry, Dr. Jenkins. Are you okay?"
"I think so."
"Good. I'm really sorry. Just having a little trouble here in the virtual documentary world. Can I ask you to pick up where you left off?"
"Yeah, it'd be wonderful."
"You were talking about the transgressive quality and how it works in some of the commercial video games."
"Okay. The problem is we've allowed that sense of transgression to be co-opted mindlessly toward criminal elements, toward fantasies of, you know, just blowing people away, when in fact what kids want to play with is a sense of power, a sense that their actions in the world matter, have consequences, a sense that they have a certain autonomy from the people who control and regulate their lives, and their ways of channeling those fantasies that make games a very effective technology for teaching. You know, on the one hand, if it feels too much like green vegetables, if it feels like something that's purely good for you, then kids are not going to engage with it with the same level of passion as they engage with the games they stay up all night playing. If, on the other hand, it's too transgressive, it looks too popular, then educators are going to have stronger challenges from parents and from school boards about using those games in the classroom. So you've got to find that middle ground, and that's going to take some effort."
"Welcome. You've entered the world of electromagnetism."
This may be that middle ground. One of half a dozen games being developed by Dr. Jenkins' Games to Teach project at MIT, it's designed to teach electromagnetism, not by sugarcoating a lesson with video game effects, but by building principles of electromagnetism into the very way you play the game.
Look ahead, that looks like a charged particle.
The aim of the MIT project is to invent groundbreaking games like this, then partner with commercial game manufacturers to develop them. And as they design these educational games of the future, Henry Jenkins and his colleagues may be finding clues to the nature of the learning process itself.
Some of it is something as simple as there's an emotional stake in the game problem. It's something we care about. It's something that feels real to us. We're really there. We're really doing something. There's some risk that we're facing. There's some challenge we're trying to overcome. There's some reason we're doing what we're doing. I think what's interesting is we've discovered about building games to teach is the very first step is to ask what it is this information is good for. What does it allow you to do? Because in order to turn a problem into a game, you have to give a purpose, a motive, a set of challenges the player wants to accomplish in that game space. And that forces us to think about why we're learning what we're doing. And that may be the most fundamental lesson to come out of games in education.
Sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
Uh-oh. Now what?
Chris Brooks.
Hello, yes?
This message was programmed into the onboard computer before the start of your mission to be played back at this time.
Wow.
The time allotted for the mission has now expired. You must make a choice. Press the escape key to exit gracefully, or press restart to begin again.
Thanks. I think I'll quit while I'm ahead.
Congratulations. This documentary is now ended.
Game Over was produced by Chris Brooks. Production assistant was Katie Gott. The voice of the computer was performed by Mike Jones and Duke Nukem. This program is part of our ongoing series on education and technology and is funded by the United States Department of Education. For more information or links to other programs in our series, visit us online at soundprint.org. Support for Soundprint comes from Toadnet, a provider of business and residential DSL throughout the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Visit toad.net to learn more about Toadnet's internet services or call 877-GET-TOAD. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. CDs of Soundprint are also available. They cost $12.50. To order, call us toll-free at 1-888-38-TAPES. That's 1-888-38-TAPES. If you'd like to be reminded of upcoming programs, or if you have questions or comments for us, email us at talkback@soundprint.org. We'd love to hear from you. When we memorialize war, it's often the battles and the victories that we remember. On the next Soundprint, we also remember the atrocities.
There were many things we did that are not acceptable. We blamed the Germans, and we did the same thing. We beat them. We electrocuted them. We killed them.
Dutch war crimes, part of War and Forgiveness, next time on Soundprint. Soundprint is Technical Director Anna Maria De Freitas, Associate Producer Katie Gott, and Sound Engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our Executive Producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Barbara Bogave.